fire insurance company and others versus Union Insurance Exchange and others. Warranty Carlton, George A. Somerville, Town Council, Stephen A. Horvath, John E. Boyd,
You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Carlton, and George Somerville and I represent Nationwide Insurance in this matter. And very, very briefly, the basic facts are these. Moses Manzor was driving a vehicle owned by East Coast Insulators. As part of work, Manzor was performing as an independent contractor for East Coast when he was involved in an accident with a vehicle operated by Martin Claiborne. Tragically, Mr. Claiborne died as a result of that accident. The Claiborne estate sued Manzor for wrongful death in the Loudoun County Circuit Court, and this case concerns priorities of liability coverage for Manzor under policies issued by Erie Insurance and Nationwide Insurance. East Coast was initially named as a defendant in the lawsuit and was dropped early on when it became clear that East Coast had no liability.
Is this implicating the indemnity provision in the general subcontract involved?
That is correct. There was no liability on the part of East Coast, so there was no indemnification claim, and that's what we're going to talk about in just a moment. But the policies at issue are these. First is the Erie Business Auto Policy that insured the specific vehicle that Manzor was operating at the time of the accident. That is the vehicle that was owned by Erie's named insured East Coast. And it's uncontested that Manzor was a permissive user of that vehicle. Second is the Nationwide Business Auto Policy that was issued to Rodriguez Construction, who was Manzor's employer. Nationwide also issued a commercial general liability, a CGL policy, to Rodriguez Construction. And it's our position that that policy does not apply here at all. We'll get back to that in just a moment. And third, we have two excess policies, one issued by Erie, one issued by Nationwide, to their respective named insureds. And it just so happens that that is precisely the correct order of priorities of coverage for Manzor in this matter. The trial court ruled otherwise. In its February 26, 2016 final order, the trial court ruled that all three Nationwide policies, including the CGL policy, applied before the Erie policies. And that leads us to assignment of error one, and that is that the trial court erred in ruling that the Nationwide CGL policy applies at all in this matter. That policy, like all CGL policies, contains the standard auto exclusion that bars coverage for any claims or injuries arising out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of an auto, a boat, or an aircraft. And by its plain terms, that exclusion bars coverage to Manzor, who was sued for his alleged negligent operation of an automobile.
One of the arguments that your opponent makes is that basically, that argument is moot because of the liability of the other two policies. I believe you take issue with that. Tell me why.
We do. Both of the parties asked for a declaration of coverage or a declaration as to whether the CGL policy even applied at all. And I think the parties are entitled to that declaration. And we shouldn't have gotten to the two or more policies provision in the CGL policy at all. The policy doesn't apply on its face. And after this proceeding, the next step in this process is going to be a reimbursement action between the parties, where Nationwide is going to seek reimbursement from Erie for amounts that it paid, depending on the ruling of this court. It's vital that we have from this court a declaration of the policies that actually apply here, so that in the second action, where we're talking about reimbursement, the parties can focus on the terms and provisions of only the policies at issue. So I think it's important that we have the declaration that the parties asked for with regard to the CGL policy and whether it applies. And what the trial court did with regard to the CGL policy was say that the insured contract exception to the contractual liability exclusion rendered the separate auto exclusion inapplicable. And without belaboring the point, that's addressed fully in our briefs. There are fundamental problems with the trial court's ruling. CGL policies were never meant to provide coverage for auto claims. That's why we have separate auto and general liability policies for businesses and individuals.
Why don't you move on to the Erie auto policy and have it part of the coverage liability organization policy and why?
And that is assignment of error, too, that the nationwide policies apply before the Erie policies, including the Erie policy that provide coverage to the vehicle in question. This is not an unusual circumstance. These are not unusual policies in Virginia. We have a permissive user under a policy that specifically insures the vehicle in question. That is the business auto policy issued by Erie. And we have a secondary policy that insures the driver as the operator of a non-owned automobile. That is the nationwide business auto policy. The two policies have the standard other insurance provisions that we see in all of these policies that specifically set out the priorities of coverage in this very situation. The Erie policy states that its coverage is primary for the vehicles that it specifically insures.
Can I interrupt you there?
Sure.
If we were to accept that premise, would it be necessary to go to the permittee statute to hold that permittee statute coverage in policies triggers primary liability?
You're talking about 38.2204, the omnibus statute?
Would it be necessary to go that far? I know you want us to. I'm just wondering, logically, why would we need to do that if the auto is owned by the insured, it's a primary covered vehicle, and the other insurance clauses get together nicely?
I think you're right, Your Honor. I think the omnibus clause is clear enough that the policy insuring the vehicle in question must provide primary coverage. I don't know if there's a case from this court that specifically says that in all situations. Certainly counsel will argue otherwise, but I think the omnibus statute requires that Erie provide primary coverage in this matter. And that's the long-standing Virginia practice per the terms of the policies that we see all the time, per the omnibus statute. The Erie policy insuring that subject vehicle provides the primary coverage. The non-owned coverage under the nationwide business auto policy is secondary, just as it says it is. Now, what the trial court did was say you disregard the omnibus statute. The trial court ruled that the omnibus statute doesn't even apply to these policies, and I have no explanation for that, and there was no reason for that given. That you disregard the omnibus statute and you disregard the specific terms of the policies themselves and look instead to the subcontract between East Coast and Rodriguez Construction. That subcontract has an indemnity provision where Rodriguez Construction agreed to indemnify East Coast for any claims arising out of Rodriguez Construction's work, and the court pointed to the St. Paul versus American International case out of the Fourth Circuit in 2004 in support of that. And and it goes to the issue you addressed, there are fundamental problems with the court's ruling. First and foremost, there was no indemnification claim here. There was no liability on the part of East Coast. They were dropped from that lawsuit early on.
Counsel cites a case out of the Eighth Circuit, Clarendon, for the proposition that if there is an indemnity clause, even if East Coast is not named, Clarendon seems to say that doesn't matter. Help me with that analysis.
Clarendon had not only an indemnification provision, a standard indemnification provision similar to what we have here, but also had broader indemnity language where the lessee assumed the liability of any and all claims arising out of the lessee's use of the vehicle. That is not what we have here in the subcontract at issue. What we have here is an indemnification provision where Rodriguez agreed to indemnify East Coast for any claims against East Coast.
But didn't it also, and I understand that argument, but mm-hmm. doesn't the indemnification claim also go, it's broader than causes of action? It also includes causes of action, suits, losses, judgments, obligations, and any liabilities, very similar to the Clarendon language.
Well, I would say it's not similar to Clarendon. What it does is it says Rodriguez will indemnify East Coast mm-hmm. for any of those claims that you mentioned, any claims, causes of action, judgments, duties, whatever. But what they did, and what's different than Clarendon, the lessee in Clarendon said, we are responsible for any of all, the universe of claims that might arise out of the lessee's work. Rodriguez Construction didn't do that here. What it said was specifically, we will indemnify East Coast for any claims against East Coast arising from the work.
And because East Coast is not a party, your position is there is no indemnification.
So it's very broad, but just as to East Coast.
That is correct. That is correct.
What about the clause right above that? Your opponent alludes to that. So you have Section 10, the indemnification clause, and then Section 9 talks about you have to maintain insurance to protect not just the owner and contractor, but also the subcontractor. Does that play any role, and how does that fit with Clause 10?
Well, I think that clause was satisfied. I mean, we have policies here issued by Erie and Nationwide that would provide coverage. They obviously provide coverage to Rodriguez Construction. They would provide coverage.
So that clause is you got to get the insurance, and then the next clause is, all right, well, here's what the insurance is supposed to cover.
That's right, and this is important as well. I see in subcontracts similar to this all the time, provisions that set out what the priorities of coverage ought to be. They're called primary and non-contributory clauses. We see them all the time, and you can contract for a situation where the subcontractors procure insurance, and that insurance is supposed to be primary and non-contributory. It's a standard provision. It's not here. Rodriguez Construction procured the insurance that it was required to procure. The priorities is a separate issue. The priorities are not addressed here. The priorities are addressed in the policies themselves and are governed by the omnibus statute. And I will reserve the remainder of my time for you.
May it please the Court. Steve Horvath, Mr. Manzor, and Erie. I'd like to correct the record. First issue here. The record before Judge Weimer had nothing to do with the non-suit of East Coast. In fact, the record, according to Judge Weimer, was that East Coast was a party to the litigation. If you look at the stipulation of facts, which is found at page 274, it says at page 274, attached as Exhibit G is a true and correct copy of the complaint filed against Mr. Rodriguez Manzor and the Circuit Court of Loudoun County. And then the last one, number 16 on page 276, Mr. Manzor and East Coast Insulators tendered, he and East Coast, tendered their defense indemnification. It goes on at page 523.
Well, what was the first paragraph that you cited, Counsel?
The first paragraph makes reference to the lawsuit. I'm sorry, it's paragraph 8, and that references the lawsuit. And the lawsuit that was attached, that was before the Circuit Court in Prince William County, had East Coast as a party. That was the only record that was before the trial judge in this case. The issue concerning the non-suit was brought up on the appeal for the first time. It was not brought to the attention of the trial court. So we have a situation here where
it's new that East Coast was non-suit.
It was not brought to the court's attention. I think that's important because you ask the question whether the court committed error. And now you're saying, okay, we're going to introduce a fact that wasn't before the trial judge. Say this is a fact that I didn't have, it would change it. I didn't think we did that on the call. I thought the record was what happened and was argued to the trial court. And that's what we have.
So would it matter if the trial court admitted it?
I don't think it makes any difference. under the Clarendon decision now, I don't think that makes any difference at all. And the importance is that under the Clarendon decision, if you think about it, this is what happened. East Coast has a subcontract for Rodriguez and says, you can use our vehicle, but you got to get insurance for it, and if we're sued, you got to indemnify it.
But once East Coast is out of the case, they're not sued.
That's correct, but there's still an obligation on the part of Rodriguez Construction, the named insured for Nationwide, to get insurance. East Coast had no obligation to get any insurance whatsoever. They give his vehicle to the third
party. To get insurance, but if East Coast is not sued, are they obligated to indemnify them?
The indemnification clause does not apply if they're not a party, but that doesn't change the obligation to have insurance, and nor does it change our analysis that the parties can, by agreement, affect priority. The purpose of 38.22204, as stated by this court in the case of Enterprise and Farmers and Enterprise, was to protect the injured party. That's the purpose of it. You have two policies, both issued under 38.22204. Nationwide asserted at the trial level that their policy was issued pursuant to 38.22204. Paragraph 12 of their trial brief made that express statement. So there's no question there's a policy there. 38.22204 doesn't say who is primary. It doesn't say that. It just says you have to have coverage. And it gives omnibus coverage so that if someone else is driving the vehicle, there's a policy there. It doesn't say it's primary.
What cause of action would the injured plaintiff have against these cases anyway?
There's a presumption that the owner of the vehicle, the driver is the agent of the owner of the vehicle. And there could be a negligent
entrustment
argument there. That was never...
The contractor's employee and the agent of the general contractor?
There is an argument that can be made. I'm not saying it's valid. But the purpose, that was never fleshed out at the trial level.
Because the party was out of the case. The general contractor wasn't in the case. Who's going to argue that if they're not there?
Well, the problem was that was never brought to Judge Weimer's attention.
You say it wasn't brought to his attention, but if you look at the complaint doesn't mention that at all. I mean, the complaint, the declaratory judgment action, is all about whether or not there's coverage for Manzoor.
That's correct.
There's no allegation made in there that East Coast is a defendant in the same lawsuit.
That's because Mr. Manzoor joined in on the lawsuit. East Coast did not join in on the lawsuit.
But if it were relevant to your defense, wouldn't you have said that in your defense to the declaratory judgment action? That East Coast was a defendant in the same lawsuit, and it's relevant, and that's why we bring the indemnification clause into play here?
We did. We had a stipulation to that effect.
Well, you claim that stipulation at J274 is how you got it there?
Yes.
By, like, just referring to the cover of the lawsuit?
That's not only that, but we referred to the fact that East Coast made a demand for indemnification.
Yeah, but you didn't say that they were a defendant in the lawsuit.
No, we didn't say that again separately.
And that's the only thing that makes it relevant, it seems like to me, in this particular instance.
Well, for that part of it, but then again, you go to the Clarendon decision. And the whole point is, if I'm going to give you a car and say, you can use my car, but I want you to get insurance for my car, and you have to buy insurance, and if there's any cause of action against me, you indemnify me, then that is essentially what we have here.
Well, what cause of action was there against East Coast? We're talking in circles here, and I'm confused. There was no cause of action non-suit extended, and it sounds like to me there wasn't any viable legal cause of action anyway, because no one ever alleged that the guy was an agent of the general contractor.
And again, the record is silent on that. I don't know what the reason basis.
Question, which is, you should have brought that up.
I don't know if I was going to bring up a theory of liability against another insured.
If you're saying that my client has a right to be indemnified by this guy, you got to lay the predicates for why your client gets that indemnity.
Sure, there's a duty to defend, though. The duty to defend under insurance policies, even if the lawsuit's frivolous or meaningless, has no basis whatsoever, there's still an obligation to come in here and have a defense. This lawsuit, the deck action, was to provide a defense and indemnification. There's two purposes of it. So even though it's a frivolous lawsuit and has no basis whatsoever in law, in fact, you still have to defend it. That's basic insurance law. That's why it's there. But to go back to the issue,
counsel, you're relying on Clarendon, and opposing counsel argues that liability coverage language is very different from your coverage language. And if you look at the case, it provides Arkansas Painting assumed responsibility for any and all liability for injury caused by the operation, use, control, handling, transportation of the truck.
That's right.
Which seems to be broader than your indemnification language.
I would argue that they're equivalent, because if you look at our indemnification language found in the subcontract agreement, and let me find it again. The difficulty is the version we have in the joint record is very hard for me to read.
Yeah,
as I'm
that's
getting
why
older.
I got my glasses out. I couldn't either. But yours seems to be premised on a claim against East Coast, and then all of these other liabilities flow from that. That's the bedrock.
The premise of the argument is that the courts have universally in this country held that if you have an obligation in a contract to provide insurance and indemnification, that obligation will determine the priorities of coverage. There's no question the Nationwide policy provides coverage. The question is, how do you determine the priorities? Nationwide doesn't challenge that you can determine priorities by a separate agreement. And to your specific issue, the indemnification clause that in this contract says, to the fullest extent permitted by law, subcontractor hereby agrees to indemnify, defend, and hold harmless at subcontractor's sole expense, the contractor, the owner, et cetera, from any and all claims for bodily injury. It's actually broader, I think, than the Clarendon language. It's an extremely broad.
So the language, though, is you. The full extent permitted by law, you're supposed to indemnify the general contractor.
That's correct.
Okay, well, the general contractor didn't have any liability.
Well, the general contractor initially was sued, so there was an obligation to provide a defense, which they failed to do. That's one of the issues in the case. And then the question is, how does that determine priority? The Clarendon case, there's a footnote in there, which I think is extremely telling, because what it in essence says is this. If you accept Nationwide's argument, the only time that Nationwide policy will be primary is if East Coast is negligent. But if East Coast is not negligent, their policy is never primary. That doesn't make any sense at all. And that's exactly what the Eighth Circuit said. That is preposterous to think that we're only going to say that Nationwide has priority if East Coast is negligent.
Well, isn't that the only time that they would have liability and they would need a defense and they would need to be indemnified?
The question here is not, the question here is priority of policies, though. That's the issue that we're trying to talk about here, is the priority of policies.
Yeah, but I mean, it seemed like to you it was mystifying that they wouldn't have to provide indemnity unless the contractor was liable. Well, why would you provide indemnity if they're not liable?
Because you always have a duty to provide a defense. And that's where
Nationwide
fell down. They absolutely ignored all requests for coverages, didn't even tell us about the existence of auto policy despite subpoenas. We finally found out about it later, and they totally ignored it, that they had an obligation to provide a defense. And the question now is whether or not Erie's policy, which was issued to East Coast, which was not the operator of the vehicle, or Nationwide policy, which was issued to Rodriguez, who was the operator of the vehicle, should have priorities. And it's our position that the case law under the Walmart case, under the St. Paul case from the Fourth Circuit, from the Clarendon case, those cases have held that if you have a contract that says you are going to provide insurance and indemnification, then you have priority.
So your logic then separates the duty to defend from the duty to indemnify, and if you can fit into the gigantic orb of frivolous claims that trigger the duty to defend, you instantly get the liability coverage for the duty to indemnify.
No, I think
that's what the Eighth Circuit said. I'm questioning whether they're right versus whether the opposite of the box is.
Well, I frankly, almost every court that's looked at it has found, as far as we can tell, has found that way. That you look at the agreement to determine the priorities of the parties. If I could address the issue, the next issue, because there's no question they say that they've got $1 million of auto policy. They just say Erie's goes first, and we go second. The next issue concerns the issue of the excess insurance clause. We have an excess clause. They have an other insurance clause. This court in GEICO versus Universal Underwriters had the same language that we have in our case, and that is if you have a language that this insurance is excess over whether primary, excess, or contingent on any other basis, that means that it's like a super excess clause. If you compare that to an other insurance clause like they have, our clause, Erie's clause, trumps. And so under the scenario, that would be that Nationwide's umbrella policy is triggered before Erie's umbrella policy is triggered. And that is because the application of the language that we have, this court called it the other insurance escape clause. And the other insurance escape clause that we have has the exact same language, quote, whether primary, excess, or contingent, close quote, that was in the GEICO case. And as a result of that, our position is that the priority of coverages should be got Nationwide for their auto because of the fact that they were the ones operating the vehicle. It was their driver. And by the agreement, it should be split that way. Then their umbrella policy would come into play, and then our auto policy, and then our umbrella policy.
If we don't find that the indemnification clause applies, then what would be your argument with regard to priorities?
I would submit that the insurance clause would apply. There's two clauses in there. And most importantly is the insurance clause that says you are going to get insurance to cover this vehicle. And that creates the priority first. The obligation to provide insurance creates that priority.
So your argument would be the priorities remain as you just...
That's correct. You don't have to get to indemnification. Just look at the insurance clause. Thank you, unless there's any questions. Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Counsel, address excess and other insureds in the GEICO case, please.
I will. They are both other insurance provisions. There is not another insurance clause. It is. When you look at their policy, it says five other insurance, and then we have the pertinent provisions at issue. The Erie excess policy's other insurance provision is not at all an escape clause like you see in the GEICO versus Universal case that it cites in its brief, which is a statutory escape clause, by the way. It says, Erie's excess policy says that it's excess over and doesn't contribute with any other insurance. Nationwide's excess policy says it's excess over and won't pay until all other insurance has paid. And it says it is not subject to the other insurance provisions of any other policy. I mean, in short, they both say that they don't pay until all other insurance pays. They've got somewhat different language, but they both say we don't pay until everybody else pays. Under Virginia law, in that circumstance, they're mutually repugnant, they're irreconcilable, therefore they sit on a co-excess pro rata basis.
Okay, what's your response to the point that the trial court wasn't made aware that, because the complaint was attached, and I just pulled it up, and the complaint shows that East Coast was named, although in the declaratory judgment action, it doesn't mention East Coast. It just says, so there's at least an ambiguity, but is there elsewhere in the record where the trial judge was informed that East Coast was non-suited or not in play?
No, because it was, because coverage for East Coast was never an issue. And I think you're exactly right. Look at the pleadings in the deck action. Erie's deck action, our counterclaim for declaratory judgment, and they asked for a determination of coverage for Manzor and Manzor alone. East Coast was irrelevant. Because by that time, East Coast had already been dropped from the lawsuit. Make no mistake, you'll search in vain in the record for any mention of coverage for East Coast or any request by any party that there be a determination of coverage for East Coast, because it was simply never an issue. If there are no other questions, I'll give back the remaining time. Thank you.